Hello, and welcome to our forum on U.S. detention and interrogation policy. I'm Professor Barbara Armacost, and I'll be moderating our panel today. The forum today is jointly sponsored by the Law School's Human Rights Program, the Center for National Security Law, Virginia Law Veterans, the J.B. Moore Society of International Law, Virginia Journal of International Law, and Human Rights First. I want to extend a special thanks to Human Rights First, which has provided funding for our program today. And I also want to recognize Sharon Kelly and Carly Goodman from Human Rights First to help put today's program together. The topic of this forum, interrogation policy and the treatment of detainees in U.S. detention facilities, has been in the public consciousness since the Abu Ghraib photographs became public in April of 2004. In a CBS 60 Minutes 2 broadcast, American citizens were confronted with a series of shocking pictures of naked Iraqi detainees being humiliated and mistreated by American service members. The precise acts in the Abu Ghraib photographs were extreme, but they were an extreme example of a broader phenomenon that occurred in other detention facilities. We now know that military interrogators in multiple theaters employed questionable or abusive techniques to interrogate detainees. We also know that CIA agents were specifically authorized to use so-called enhanced interrogation procedures to get detainees to talk. Both presidential candidates have made a point of saying that they oppose torture, but that denunciation does not begin to capture the complex questions that will need to be addressed by whoever is chosen to occupy the White House. That person will have the job of evaluating the fruits of our post-9/11 interrogation policies and setting interrogation policy for the future. Today, we will hear from two men who together have many decades of experience and knowledge regarding military law and policy, the realities of combat operations, and the requirements for ensuring national security. We invite them to bring these perspectives to the complex and important issues of U.S. interrogation and detention policy and its relationship to national security. So, without further ado, let me introduce our panelists. You may have noticed that we have two panelists instead of three as was publicized. Unfortunately, Brigadier General John H. Johns and Brigadier General Richard O'Meara had last-minute conflicts, but we're so pleased to have Lieutenant General Charles Otstadt and Lieutenant General Kerry E. Soyster join us in their stead. General Otstadt, to my right, served for 32 years in the U.S. Army as an infantryman. Over his military career, he commanded at every level, including command of the 25th Infantry Division Light from 1988 to 1990. His service included two combat tours in Vietnam. From 1990 to 1992, General Otstadt served as deputy chairman of the NATO Military Committee, which is the highest military authority in NATO. The committee's principal role is to provide direction and advice on military policy and strategy, and to recommend to NATO's political authorities those measures considered necessary for the common defense of the NATO area. General Soyster, to my far right, served as director of the Defense Intelligence Agency during Desert Storm and Desert Shield. He also served as Deputy Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence for the Department of the Army, as Commanding General U.S. Army Intelligence and Security Command, and in the Joint Reconnaissance Center for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In Vietnam, General Soyster was an operations officer in a field artillery battalion. Upon retirement, he was Vice President for International Operations with Military Professional Resources Incorporated, and he later returned to government as a Special Assistant to the Secretary of the Army for the World War II 60th Anniversary commemorations, which were completed in 2006. General Otstadt and General Soyster are part of a larger group of retired flag and general officers who've spoken out against torture and policies of official cruelty. The group has met with political leaders, pressed Congress for legislation that would guarantee humane interrogation policies, and sought to educate the public to ensure responsible and informed public debate on U.S. interrogation policy. We're so pleased to have both of you with us this afternoon. So I'm going to begin by posing a series of questions that will get our discussion going, and then I'll turn it over to our audience for their questions. We'll end right around 1 o'clock. If any of you need to leave and go to class, just slip out, and that would be fine. So the first series of questions I have for you both is a little bit about your group and its work. So General Soyster, let me begin by asking if you'd tell us a little bit about how you and the broader group of retired military leaders came together and what strategies you've been using to shape or influence U.S. interrogation policy.
Yeah, we were brought together, a group of about 40 of us, by this great group, Human Rights First, and brought together initially, my involvement was to support the McCain Amendment. And so this group came together representing, I would say maybe half of them were JAGs. It seemed a large portion, somehow lawyers seemed to be able to do that. But retired JAGs, psychiatrists, physicians, intelligence officers, and combat experienced guys. Very quickly, I didn't know what would happen in terms of we started a discussion where everybody may stand. But very quickly, it was very clear everyone was very much opposed to torture, and we signed various documents which we support the McCain Amendment. Then, as Human Rights group that's aggressive in trying to get things done, decided that the next thing we needed to do was to get together with the candidates. And so we met with eight of the presidential candidates when there were a large number running. We traveled to South Carolina, New Hampshire, Iowa, wherever they were, and met with a group of about 15 of us. One of the candidates was exchanged for about an hour, and some came back even for seconds with us. And then continued that effort in terms of trying to reach the right people by going to both conventions, Democrat and Republican, to try to get the right plank in the platform. And then are continuing, as you see, visiting, working with editorial boards, universities, other groups, to try to ensure that the discussion is raised to a level that everyone should address and not some short things that you pick up. Where this technique does work, it does work on 24, once a week or whatever, and so we want to get the discussion a little bit above that. And so it's been a great privilege for us to be brought together by Human Rights First, and then to have had the opportunity to sit down and talk to the candidates to get their views, and also have met with congressional leaders. I spent about 50 minutes with Senator John Warner on one of the issues, and this group continues to do that, and we now have an outlined plan to continue our efforts. So a very diverse group of retired generals and admirals, but all feeling with some compassion that we're on the right track to be against torture.
To either of you, interrogation policy during the Afghanistan-Iraq war was formulated by a group of folks together and individually, White House and Justice Department lawyers, the Secretary of Defense, and other high-level executive officials and military leaders. This policy has been widely debated and hotly contested. What unique perspectives do you as military leaders bring to this discussion?
I'll take first crack at that, I guess. I was frankly, after the revelations about Edward Graham, I was absolutely outraged about that, because that doesn't, it's not representative of the Army that I grew up in and served in, and served in Vietnam. And I couldn't imagine how we had descended into that level of abuse on the scene. So I know there's a lot of torture papers, if you will, that emanated out of the Bush administration, but basically where they came to with that was something that was shocking and embarrassing to me, and really outraged me. It's about that time that Human Rights contacted me and asked me if I would like to be a member of this group, and I certainly decided to do that. Ed and I were both raised, we were educated at West Point, we were both raised with the idea that Geneva Conventions are the way you handle people on the battlefield. And it doesn't matter what kind of people they are. When you take a detainee on the battlefield, you are representing the United States of America. You're not second battalion, 502nd, not A Company, 35th Infantry, representing the United States of America, to do that. And until they come before a tribunal which judges them something else, you must treat them as a prisoner of war, entitled all to the convention protections at the instant they're taken into your custody. So, when I went to the battlefield in Vietnam with the company commander, that's the way we treat people. And it boils down to, you can couch it in lots of legal language, but it boils down to the golden rule. You do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's basically what's at the heart and soul of how we treat the detainees on the battlefield. And I've taken detainees on the battlefield in Vietnam and treated them that way. And we were guided by a certain number of principles. You searched them, you segregated them, you sped them back for interrogation, etc. And we never had any difficulty with that. And they were not always uniformed members carrying their arms openly. They were just like the guys that are being detained in Afghanistan and Iraq today. They hide their arms and they run around in civilian clothes. When you take them as a detainee, you don't know what they are. They may be an Al-Qaeda suspect. They may be a soldier on leave. They may be just a civilian. The rules are the same. Should be the same. And all the Machiavellian work that has been done to get around those rules is detestable. And I can't believe that we are doing that as an official policy in the United States of America. It just doesn't register.
Thank you. I want to come back in a minute to the Geneva Conventions discussion. But let me, as we get into talking more about the specific issue of aggressive or abusive interrogation, I want to first a clarification. A lot of the conversations surrounding this debate talks about the word torture, as if we all know what it is. So one question I wanted you all to address is, when does so-called aggressive interrogation become torture, or is there a line between the two? Is the category we call torture the only kind of interrogation we should be concerned about, or are there other things we should also be concerned about? So maybe you could kind of clarify the terminology a little bit for us.
Well, I think the key, and there was a rewriting, I don't know the exact wording, a rewriting of the definition of torture by high-level lawyers, personnel at the Department of Defense, which broadened it to the point that it was something that may cause organ failure or death. That's getting pretty close to something that's pretty bad. And so it started to have the policy not clear. Charlie brought up an important point in terms of the treatment of detainees, a couple of aspects of it. One is that humane treatment has to start at the point of the bayonet when they're captured. The expert interrogators have told us that if they're abused in some way, getting back to the interrogators, they're already hardened and already very reluctant to talk and begin good interrogation techniques. So the basic thing that's in the Army Field Manual is, as Charlie mentioned, it's basically the golden rule. Would you want someone to do this to the soldiers that you command? And if the answer is no, you don't do it to the enemy. It's about us, it's not about them. And it doesn't matter what they do, it's about what we do. We don't suddenly lower ourselves to the level of this terrible enemy that we're fighting. It's about what our standards are. And so I don't need, for instance, and this is a law school, I don't need a lawyer to tell me whether I'm torturing somebody. That's pretty clear to me. And it's very important, and it has to be that simple, because we're talking about the possibility of thousands of people suddenly becoming involved with different people that you train who will confront someone. The other important thing is if you torture in terms of losing the ability then to use good interrogation techniques, it's very important, as I mentioned, it starts from the very beginning. And you don't have to be real smart to know whether you're torturing someone. Just ask, as a commander, would you want your soldiers 3 months away, and you got the answer.
The new field manual lays out some words in it that if you're looking for a precision definition and you want to know what's in and what's out, the new field manual lays that out very clearly. It talks about torture and it talks about cruel and inhuman treatment. And it lays down a number of things that are prohibited, waterboarding being one of those and other things like that. And so it's a very good lay down for the average soldier to, and all the leaders to look at and know exactly what they can and cannot do. But if there's any doubt whatsoever, it comes back to, I want to be treated that way if I became a captain. And the answer to that is usually not. I know what's in and I know what's out.
There have been high-level claims that aggressive interrogation, some might say torture, of certain detainees after 9/11 produced vital intelligence, and that this information allowed us to capture high-level terrorists and foil specific terrorist plots. If that's true, does that mean that under emergency circumstances, torture might be justified?
No. there are those claims. And I would not sit here and tell you that torture has not caused somebody to provide information. What we're talking about is a policy at the highest level. You don't make policy based on the exception. You make policy based on the norm that you expect. And so certainly I'm sure that advanced technique has gotten some information from people, and a claim may be, because of course you want to say that it works if you've just authorized it. And so I have a little bit of doubt as to who may be making these claims, and as a guy that still has all the necessary security clearances and meets with intelligence guys, I haven't had anybody sit down and say, you know, on the 27th of April 2008, we did so-and-so, and here were the results. So I haven't seen any of this. But there are claims, and I think I would be naive if I did not say that occasionally it may work, so to speak. But we don't make medical policy because someone refused medical attention and took aspirin, and all of a sudden their cancer went away. And so we don't start giving everybody aspirin. So the key thing is we don't make policy on the exception. And we're talking about policy now at the highest levels of government, which of course then trickles down to the young warrior that has to execute those policies.
I have some doubts about the value of any intelligence that was produced through the torture technique. And I have tremendous doubt that the people who were tortured were actual terrorists until after the torture. There's a lot of people who have been subjected to these techniques over a long span of time who may have been just swept up in a dragnet in their military age males or females, and then after they spent 3 months, 6 months, 3 years, 6 years under that kind of treatment, you come out a pretty good terrorist. You want to get back. Your vengeance will be yours. Whether or not anything has been avoided, any attacks have been avoided by this thing, I think is highly questionable. Highly questionable. And we do know that there has been some erroneous information put into the system through torture techniques, which caused us to do things that we probably shouldn't have done. So I stand firm that there's no feasible case that I can imagine where torture should be allowed, period.
There are three things that a good interrogator wants to do. First of all, get the information. Second, he wants to do it legally. That could be at the police. You know, this torture thing has application locally here. You get very upset somehow when police push somebody around. So he wants to do it legally. Nothing else to keep himself out of jail. And thirdly, he doesn't want to convert an innocent person into the terrorist that Charlie talked about. And most of the people, we have a system basically, I think here at the law school, that you're innocent and you're proven guilty. And basically, a lot of the people we capture are not potential terrorists, and they don't have information to give. And that's a terrible situation to be in if you don't know the answer and someone is trying to force that answer out of you. So we don't want to convert people who were swept up innocently in some case, or certainly not of any real intelligence value, by torturing advanced techniques or whatever new term the administration has come up with for torture.
Okay, so let me push you a little bit on this. It's been widely reported that during the early stages of the Afghanistan-Iraq War, military interrogators at least believed that they were facing terrorists who had been trained to resist traditional interrogation strategies. And so it was claimed that the strategies that were contained in the Army Field Manual were not adequate for dealing with these terrorists. So how would you respond to that claim, and does the new Field Manual acknowledge that?
Well, the field manual allows pretty aggressive techniques that are short of what would be called torture. The experts that we talked to, Charlie and I had a great experience with about 20 of them, all claim that it's a matter torture or these advanced techniques don't work. They do not bring the information that you can translate into actionable intelligence, and so they're not effective. And the techniques in the manual will allow any good interrogator, and that's a term, you know, interrogation is like any other skill. It takes good training, it takes time to get it, and experience to be a good interrogator. That's one of our problems. We need more good interrogators, because we went from zero requirements to suddenly a huge requirement, and it takes time to do that. You know, you can't go to law school in 2 weeks and become a good lawyer. So it's very important to have good interrogators, and they feel comfortable that the methods described in the training manual. Remember, this is the Field Manual is a training manual. It's based on what we think the laws and the requirements are, and you train to that standard. But what's allowable in the Field Manual, the good interrogators say, is very adequate. I would tell you this as a biased guy, in terms of the CIA, which have been given different authorities, and do not want to be held to the Army Field Manual. The reality is the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States, this is my biased view, is not going to work under the Field Manual of the United States Army, even if it authorized decapitation. It just politically doesn't work with the CIA. I've only worked with it for 10 years. So that's one of the things. But there needs to be a clear standard given. And again, the manual is a training manual, so that we train people to use the right techniques. And it's been offered as a standard across the board, which we also feel very strongly about. Members of the CIA are also Americans, and the fact that their paycheck comes in a blue form rather than a green one, like the military, doesn't give them any special rights to do torture.
I think the idea that because certain numbers of people have been trained to resist interrogation techniques, therefore normal interrogation techniques, therefore extraordinary interrogation techniques are okay, is an excuse, not a reason. And if you make that in your mind, that you're doing this thing in an unlawful fashion, in my view, then you have to have some way to sell that to the troops. Those troops are not stupid, and they will see through that. They've got good leadership. They have good leadership. At the lowest level, they will do what's right. But if you want to give them a reason to do something extraordinary, you've got to give them some kind of a reason. I think that's what they did, and I call that an excuse.
So do you think, just to follow up on that, do you think that the strategies in the field manual, if used properly by trained people, are adequate against terrorists who are trained to resist?
Yes.
Yes, and terrorists, you know, are General Sinakis, who was our psychiatrist physician, points out that in spite of what we may think about the enemy, they are human beings. They have human weaknesses. They worry about their family. They're narcissistic guys. They worry about their position in the organization and what they're going to have when they get out. They have all these human weaknesses. And an interrogator, in good interrogation techniques, looks for a weakness. And they have them. They have, and so if you use the right techniques, you can get through that. These techniques, these advanced techniques, were reverse engineered. They started when we have training, so the pilot shot down and others went through this training to prepare them a little bit for what they may face. And that included waterboarding, boarding, stress positions, hypothermia. These techniques were used to get our guys perhaps ready in some way for what they may face. The CIA reverse engineered that and decided that they were good techniques. I will tell you also that interrogation is not a core competency of the CIA. When we met with our 20 experts and we had two representatives from CIA, they weren't interrogators because they didn't have any. They were case officers whose had similar techniques in terms of getting into someone's mind and converting them to being a spy, so there were similar techniques. But it's a new phenomenon for the CIA. So the idea that they have some experts out there, they may hire some contractors, but they don't have guys that have come up in CIA as interrogators. I'll stop talking about the
Another point on it is that when you do these enhanced interrogation techniques, you can't tell them what they're telling you. Because they'll tell you anything that you, that they think you want to hear to make a pain sound. So you can, if you say, well, this guy is trying to resist normal interrogation, so I'm talking to him a little bit. And he tells you that it's dark out there right now. And you say, it's dark out there. Okay, I got it. You can go tell your boss about that. This man reports it's dark out there. And you act on that. You're way off. And you cannot trust the intelligence, quote unquote, that you get from someone that you had tortured. And we're finding out now that you can't even use it in the military tribunals. So, what good?
And I'm sure you'll get the implications internationally as well. If I may, let me tell you, with my experience, Colonel Stu Harrington, who was, in my view, the best guy I ever had when the first Gulf War started, the commander there, General Thurman, called me and said, who's the best guy that you know? And I said, Stu Harrington. He said, get him down here. And Stu was an interrogator in Vietnam, first Gulf War. Panama, first Gulf War, about three times in Iraq, and let me just give you a little vignette, and you know, this is one experience, but how a good technique works. He was selected to interrogate a high-level Al-Qaeda guy. We knew he was a lot about him, and that's very important. The interrogator, if you want to scare someone, bring him in and tell him, you know, it's a police technique as well, and tell him what you know about it. Please call somebody in and say, we know that you were not at this place last night. You did so-and-so, we have DNA and so forth. And that's a very good way to start off in terms of let them know how much you already know about them and begin this conversation. And Stu tells us this story. So this process is going, and he begins to sense as they're talking that this prisoner was very concerned about his family. Been a prisoner for a couple of weeks, out of touch with his family, very concerned about it. Further conversation, he was particularly concerned about his sister. So as this conversation goes on, he's gathering this information. He said, would you like to talk to your sister? Well, you're concerned about your sister, you'd like to talk to her? Well, yes, he would. Get her on the phone, get a number. So they talk. He starts to cry as he is talking to his sister. So there's now no doubt, we got a weakness in this guy. happens to have great concern about his family. Conversation goes on. Stu said, finds out that it's particularly concerned because of the location. She's a Shiite, she's in a Sunni area where the problem was. Would you like to move your sister? You're concerned about her location. Would you like to move? So they move. Conversation continues. And then, after those two acts, this guy begins to talk. And what you gather as an interrogator is not the specific thing of where is this bomb placed or something, but he begins to talk about his uncle, who makes these frequent trips down to so-and-so. That's also where two other people go. And you gather information by simply talking. There was a great German interrogator, his last name I can never remember, his first name was Hans, not unusual. So, and he's written a book, and he's cited everywhere. He was a graduate of American University, spoke fluent English, knew American culture and so forth. And he talked to the downed pilots. And he just talked to them. You know, when you get shot down, so yeah. You know, that's the same, wasn't at the same time, you know Charlie Osta? Oh yeah, he was in the other squadron. All this information is coming, they have no idea that they are giving him important intelligence. Because he just talked to them, back to the prison, and the next guy came in, and now they know a little bit about him. You know him, and they put it together, and that's what a good interrogator is able to do. So, you got a lot of good results by using good interrogation and getting into the mind of the guy that you're trying to get information from.
I was going to ask you to give us some examples last week. Thank you very much. I wanted to move into a slightly different area, which is there's been a lot that's been made of the President's Declaration in February of 2002 that made the Geneva Conventions applicable to prisoners of war, nor coming Article 3, the conventions applied to Afghan and Taliban detainees. These detainees were deemed to fall into a category of so-called unlawful combatants. I have two questions about that. First of all, could you say a little bit about Common Article 3, what it is, and what the military's basic view of the scope of that article? And then secondly, could you tell us a little bit about what's meant by that phrase unlawful combatants, and whether that's a common term that's always been part of the military, or if that's a new term, and what that term usually means, and how are those kinds of things being treated? So, on Article 3, and then the unlawful combatant category.
Those are probably better questions for people with a legal background.
Okay.
I'm a common soldier.
Okay.
And one of the things that was appalling to me watching the open press was this statement by the President.
Right.
And subsequent behavior after it just. Could imagine. Soldiers need clear guidance. They need simple guidance and clear guidance. And when I was a company commander in Vietnam, I tried to do that. I'll give you one example. Doesn't have to do with treatment of detainees, but it has to do with the law of land work. And it's in the very first firefight that I got into with my company, 101st Airborne Division in 67, we had a very sharp engagement for about 2 days. And it began with a couple of soldiers and a couple of North Vietnamese soldiers in a rock outcropping about 75 meters off the trail we were walking down. We were able, after these 2 days of maneuvering and putting in fires, to take the position that as we moved past that rock outcropping, the two soldiers that were there from the North Vietnamese Army had been killed the day before. And we walked right past them as we went out, and one of them had been decapitated after. And a car from our unit was stuck on his forehead. A calling card, if you will. We got to the very next place where we were going to be, which was on the finger that we had taken from the enemy, about 200 meters away, and I stopped the company. And I'd been in command about 10 days. And I gathered the leaders, and said, look, I don't know what the policy has been in this company in the past, but that is a war crime. Mutilation of a corpse on the battlefield of a war crime, you will never, ever do that again. You get the word out there, every soldier in this company under the eagle. If this company does not do that and will not do that again, I better not see it anymore. That's never had another problem as a time that I was in command. And that's the kind of low-level leadership, in my view, that we need to stop this kind of stuff. So we don't need guidance from the top that says they can be treated like animals.
Mm-hmm.
That is a bad thing to do, because that trickles right on down. And that's the purpose, the reason why we went to see the candidates during the primary, was to try and get our views of every candidate that this is bad stuff. When you make pronouncements like that, it goes right to the bottom of the chain of command. And when that happens, then every soldier who is not supervised by a good NCO or a good junior officer will apply his own personal ethic to the battlefield. And if he's not bringing in, he will see that, hey, the president said these people were not going to the convention, so I can treat them any way I want. When that happens, you've lost the discipline, you've lost the code, and you're subject to every grade coming up and recurring. And you just can't go out of habit. So we're trying to get whoever might be elected as the next president of the United States to understand the importance of a simple, direct, and humane approach to this problem. And that included recognition of Common Article 3, which essentially says you will not treat people cruelly and inhumanely.
And it's a fundamental one. I can remember 50 years ago, I was told as a lieutenant to bear a one-hour training session on the Geneva Conventions, and that plan was a land warfare. So it's very fundamental in terms of the military. It was written, the writers also thought in writing that there would be also some reciprocal benefit, that everybody was on the same standard. You had a certain expectation from the signers, and I think that certainly the United States has been a country that has been looked at, and when we signed a document like that, that we tried to execute it. And so from a military standpoint, it's been so fundamental in our culture that hearing that it didn't apply to this particular enemy, I think My own experience, I found enemies different in Vietnam than I did in the First Gulf War, or reading in history, the various enemies we faced. The fundamentals still apply, no matter how bad our enemies were. And the cultural part to the military, I think, is a very important part of why we feel so strongly that with the concept that everyone should be treated, someone else can determine whether someone else is, falls in some category of unlawful combatant. To the soldier, when you're being shot at, you don't say, "Well, I don't have to worry about that guy. He's unlawful," and his bullet, instead of having your name on it, just says to whom it may concern, and so you worry about them as well. You can't sort that sort of thing out on the battlefield. And the battlefield today, we'll talk more, I think, about the role of the commander in chief and what that means to soldiers. But we can't ask soldiers to sort that out, even bright young captains.
Along those lines, it's my impression that we just had an immediate wake of another veteran pandemic. The president and his advisors are likely to do whatever it takes to try to confirm the country's safety, no matter what prohibitions are in place, including ordering CIA and military officials to be aggressive in interrogating terrorists. Assuming that you believe some of the techniques that were used after 9/11 should be made legally legal, how will additional legislation or revised field manuals make any difference in those kind of emergencies?
That's sort of the ticking time bomb scenario. A particular situation,
I'm asking a slightly different question, which is not whether enhanced interrogation is justified by emergency. But slightly different question, which is, if we think, and maybe I'm wrong about this, that a president in the wake of a 9/11 is going to do what the president did, at least in the immediate wake of 9/11, how would, and assuming, as I think I'm assuming correctly, that you all believe that some of those enhanced procedures were illegal or should not be repeated, how would changes in legislation or changes in the field manual make a difference?
Well, changes in the field manual or changes in some of the legislation, how that affects the President of the United States is probably going to depend on who the President of the United States is and what he feels he has to do. What we don't want is for the President of the United States to say, I will do anything to defend this country. Because that translates down to one of these young guys who's beaten down a door in Iraq, and the door opens, and there's explosives in the corner, and there's two guys with all their stuff on, and there's a piece of paper, a roadmap, and a couple of X's, and it looks like that's where they're going to plant the IEDs. The sergeant, we don't want the sergeant to say, well, my commander-in-chief will do anything to protect this country. I'm going to do anything to protect this platoon. And he begins to use, grabs the guy, begins to do interrogation that he thinks is going to protect his platoon. And for him, that platoon is just as important as the country is to the president. And that's why it needs to be very clear in policy not to do it. Whether the President of the United States would do it, my experts that we met with have said, if you want the bomb to go off, torture. So the fact that he made the decision to protect the country, this also doesn't mean that in any particular situation, we had an FBI agent say that he had overstepped the line, immediately reported to his superiors. In a situation, he did it because he was going to save a child. And so he used interrogation techniques that were illegal. If you do that and you get the information and you save the child or you save the country, probably a hero. If not, we've got places at Leavenworth, we've got them up in New York that we send you to because you violated the law. And we want a clear policy so that we know in a particular situation, you're going to take action which you know will be illegal. If the policy is clear, and you make that step, you know what you're doing. We don't want it to be an easy transition to do something unlawful. We want clear policy so that you have to make that. And those kind of decisions could well be made.
In your first positive, that question you mentioned that taking means or doing anything necessary. And I think that's a political goal of mine, really, where almost any candidate for office has to be willing to say, I'll do anything to protect this country. They don't really mean that. They haven't thought that through, I guess. They thought through this one, because we have urged the next president in the meeting we had with the candidates not to say that, not to say that way, because of this case. Erroneously, all the way down the line, it's a ticking time bomb. It's all the time soldiers are kicking down doors and ragging up against them. Every time they go through there, as far as they're concerned, it's a ticking time bomb. If the president had said, well, employ all means available, then you're authorized to do all means available. And that's a wrong thing to say. And wrong thing. You've got to think about that and you say, I'll do anything I can to protect this country. Any lawful thing I can protect this country would be a better foundation. We are still a nation that respects the rule of law, I hope.
And we want to emphasize with the candidates that we met, none of whom had ever served, to get the idea of the role of the commander-in-chief and a soldier. That tell them that, you know, your picture's going to be at every order room, every battalion headquarters. And what you say is going to be known by the troops, so you got to be very careful what you say and how important their role the commander-in-chief is in terms of the relationship with the soldiers, and the fact they've taken an oath to obey you, your lawful orders. And so that was part of the process of trying to educate the potential candidates so they would understand how important their role as commander-in-chief was to our soldiers, who do know what the, sometimes they might not know what the company commander said yesterday, but they know if the commander-in-chief has said some strong statement.
And the truth is looking for guys.
Yeah.
This is a letter that I urge you all to take a look at. It's back up on there. It's General Petraeus' guidance to the troops when he took over as the commander of Multinational Force PRAC, published on the 10th of May, 2007. And he says in here, we are not in the target, period. That's what he said. And he issued that guidance because he's the senior leader on the ground. And this goes counter to the very kinds of stuff that you just mentioned earlier in the administration. But he was saying that his soldiers, everybody in Iraq, that soldiers say they're in the Marines, everybody in Iraq, that some may argue that we would be more effective if we sanctioned torture or other expedient methods to obtain information from the enemy. They would be wrong. Beyond the basic fact that such actions are illegal, history shows they are also frequently neither useful nor necessary, and it goes on down. So this is exactly the kind of guidance that I would want to have if I was a division commander or a brigade commander or a sergeant squad leader. I can look at this and say, there's my marching order. I can live with that.